You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Julia Cosberg, Vice President of Learning and Development for Wells Fargo, to introduce tonight's speakers. Please welcome Julia.
Well, welcome to this evening's program with Inforum at the Commonwealth Club, an introvert's roadmap of getting out there, featuring author and entrepreneur Maura Ahrens-Mealy in conversation with Gina Bianchini, founder and CEO of Mighty Networks. I'm Julia Cosberg, Vice President and Learning and Development Manager for Wells Fargo, and Wells Fargo is delighted to support tonight's program and the Commonwealth Club. Inforum and the Commonwealth Club convene so many vital conversations across such a wide variety of subjects, ranging from world affairs to the workplace, and create a culture of learning and engagement that Wells Fargo truly values. As a national company, Wells Fargo has always focused on building strong and supportive work culture, as well as providing ongoing learning and development opportunities for our most treasured resources, our team members. We want every team member to be able to say, I chose the right company, I'm valued. And that's why we carefully create strategies and systems that create a positive environment for talent and teams across all kinds of personalities, skill sets, and work styles. So tonight's speaker, Maura Ahrens-Mealy, in her new book, like was just mentioned, Hiding in the Bathroom, an Introvert's Roadmap of Getting Out There When You'd Rather Stay Home, highlights the importance of recognizing there's not just one right type of personality that can succeed in the world. And we're really excited to hear some of the stories from the interviews Maura has conducted with a variety of introvert leaders and learn some tips and strategies and tools of how we can evaluate our own work-life balance and hopefully create life and work based on our own personal versions of success and happiness. And now I'm really excited to introduce tonight's speakers. Maura Ahrens-Mealy is the founder of the digital marketing agency Women Online, host of the popular podcast Hiding in the Bathroom, creator of The Mission List, and the author of her new book, Hiding in the Bathroom, an Introvert's Roadmap of Getting Out There When You'd Rather Stay Home. Maura has launched digital campaigns for clients including United Nations, Malala Fund, Hillary Clinton for President, President Obama, and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She was the founding political director for BlogHer, and during the 2004 presidential election, she was the director of internet marketing for the Democratic National Committee. Now in her spare time, she writes for leading publications like the New York Times and teaches at top institutions like the Harvard Kennedy School. Tonight, Maura will be in conversation with Gina Bianchini, founder and CEO of Mighty Networks. So please join me in welcoming Maura Ahrens-Mealy and Gina Bianchini to Inforum and the Commonwealth Club.
All right. Well, before we dive into talking to Maura tonight, I was thinking we could just kind of get to know each other a little bit more. So if you guys, I think this is actually going to work. Stand up if you consider yourself an introvert. I'm going to stand. So this is one of the topics we're going to come into tonight is talking about finding your niche. This is definitely an introvert's room. So go ahead and sit down. Stand up if you also consider yourself ambitious. So about 100% of the room. I there might be somebody sitting down, but with the lights, I can't tell. All right. Stand up if you feel like you have found work-life fit. All right, so much smaller number of us, probably about a third of the room. I'm going to check out my list because I had a couple of good ones in here. Stand up if you feel like you might be missing out on something that has happened on your phone since we started this conversation. Yeah. So about two people stood up, myself included. Stand up if you have found the type of work that you love. Okay, so about, again, we're really, I'm nailing it with these questions. This is about a 90% of the room has found that. Stand up if you feel comfortable, more comfortable, I should say, in yoga pants being at your house than, or whatever the male equivalent of yoga pants is, than coming out tonight, dressing up, and showing up for tonight's event. So rather be home in yoga pants or male equivalent. Okay, so about a half. So again, we like to get out occasionally. And then stand up if you would like tonight's conversation to kind of take away a couple of really practical ideas for the rest of 2017, but also like getting a head start on your goals for 2018. Okay, that was kind of a leading question. So if you're sitting down still, we've got a little bit of a problem. But all right, thank you. Maura, it is wonderful to be here with you amongst our people.
Yes.
Amongst our introverts tonight. So what I would love for you to kick things off with is talk about what you mean by hiding in the bathroom.
I ask everyone I meet when the last time they hid in the bathroom is. In fact, I think that there were some post-its out there, and I can't wait to read your responses. To me, hiding in the bathroom is a necessary survival technique for my life and has been for many years but I didn't always think of it as like that. It's really taking care of yourself. Think of a day, and it could be a normal day if you're an introvert, if you're a hermit, which we'll get into, you're in your busy, bright office, people are in your space all day, you're on Slack, you are constantly on, you are constantly communicating, and you just need a moment. Where do you go? You go hide in the bathroom. You're in a professional conference. Did you know that there are over, I did the math on this actually, there are over 6,000 professional conferences in the U.S. every single day?
Day?
Yeah. Whoa. Well, there's like 2 million a year, so maybe not on Christmas, but you know what I mean.
Right.
You're at a professional conference. You've been schmoozing. You've been networking. You've been handing out business cards. And you feel like Superman. The kryptonite has drained all your energy. Where do you go? You take a minute to hide in the bathroom. So to me, hiding in the bathroom is shorthand for how I have learned, and many people who I've interviewed have learned, to take care of themselves while they're out there being ambitious introverts.
So let's talk about ambitious introverts, because I think one of the most amazing parts of your book is how much you share about your own experience of having big dreams and tons of ambition and like have just done amazing, amazing things and have done a lot of those amazing things from typing on your computer in your bed.
In bed.
When did you know that you were an introvert? When did you know you were a hermit?
You know, I only learned that I was an introvert a few years ago. I think it was when we started talking about this. You know, the book Quiet came out and it started, you know, becoming something that we talked about, because I remember taking the Myers-Briggs and thinking, I have to be an extrovert. I'm successful. I'm ambitious. I cannot score introvert. I think I knew how to game it, and I've talked to a lot of people. I didn't want to be an introvert, right? But I quit 9 jobs before I was 30. I was like the runaway bride of jobs. I just, like, get a job, and the same thing would happen. I would get depressed. I had many, many actual clinical depressions. I would have panic attacks. I would have terrible anxiety. I would cry in the bathroom, forget about hiding in the bathroom, and I would quit. I was so unhappy climbing the ladder, and I could not figure out why. I thought I was doing everything right.
What would you tell yourself when you were I think the technical term for it is sucking it up and thinking that, like, what was the story in the narrative that you had that allowed you to put up with it before you quit that job?
Well, I just thought it was crazy, you know, and I think also just being, I was a young woman, and sort of young women, people expect you to be a little bit emotional. Like, I remember my father would just, you know, basically tell me to suck it up. Right. Like, what do you expect? You know, I also was so accustomed to living a life of external validation. And the more I succeeded, you know, I have Ivy League degrees, I was a good athlete, I always did my best. And so when that extended to my work and getting good jobs, I got so much external validation that when I was unhappy, I just brushed it off because I didn't have the right to be unhappy. After all, what did I have to complain about, right? So I think I just soldiered through. And frankly, I drank too much. I acted out. I spent too much. I racked up credit card debt. I acted all these feelings out in the way that many of us do. And then one day I realized this has to change.
What was that day?
I quit my final.
Did you quit in a blaze of glory?
Hell no. It was actually kind of pathetic. I had wrist surgery. I think that I had a painful wrist and I turned that into a way to like ease my way out of work. And I applied to social work school. I had been a digital consultant. I had done digital marketing. I had done political marketing. I worked in very, very demanding environments in New York, in London, and then finally in Washington on K Street. And I decided I was going to become a social worker. This was my total 180. I quit my job and I said, I'm going to become a social worker. I hate working so much. I'm going to go study and get a social work degree so I can help women not hate work. I don't know even how this came to me, but it came to me. Right. So I quit, but I had to pay the bills. And so I started freelancing. And I did the same exact work that I had done in corporate America, digital marketing. I actually had the same clients. The people I had just quit became my clients. But I worked from home and I worked in my jammies and I could only see people when I needed to. And I had lots of alone time and I had lots of space and I didn't have to go to happy hours and I didn't have to deal with office politics because I was terrible at office politics. I always got pushed out every single job I had because I would just retreat. And it was like this aha moment. And I think the aha moment was I realized one day, and I'm looking at these lights, I don't have to sit under fluorescent lights anymore. I'm allergic to them. They give me migraines. And I felt free.
It's one of the things that I love about your book is that the fluorescent lights keep coming up. It's almost like there's like the villain of fluorescent lights and the hero, which is your bed.
Yes.
And I mean, it's the coolest thing in terms of how you're telling a story because
I think would have a field day with that.
Yeah, exactly. But what I also love about it is, you know, for those of us who are navigating, where do we succeed and where do we want to stay away from? The notion of finding really concrete things seems to be something that allowed you to go down a new path. What was the scariest part of your transition to being a freelancer? So many people think about doing it, but they're like, oh, I can't do it because it's hard or I have to find clients. Or what was the thing that scared you the most about the transition?
You know, for me, the transition had to happen because I was in such a depressed state. I was in a really intense clinical depression. I was having a lot of panic attacks that everyone in my life was sort of in this place where she has to change. So when I started freelancing, it was okay because I managed to keep money in the door. I think the thing that you have to think about if you're going to sort of get off the ladder and forge your own path, and I would imagine this is true if you're founding a startup or like me, you're just freelancing to try to not work in a large environment, is to have a better relationship with money. Honestly, I had to be less crazy about cash. I had to stop spending so much. I had to stop acting out. Mm-hmm. I had to learn how to manage my time and my moods. You know, working from home and working for yourself, for people who are introverted, for people who are anxious, is an incredible gift, but you also have to build in the infrastructure and the scaffolding in your life. And I talk about this a lot in the book to sustain it. But I think for me, the first thing was really having a hard conversation about my relationship with money, because you got to pay the bills.
And when did you know it was working or could work for you? What was the moment that you were like, wait a second, I might be able to do this full time?
American Cancer Society hired me. A friend took a risk on me. And thanks to my work as a blogger, and I'm looking at the amazing Lisa Stone, you know, and we'll talk about this later, I had cultivated my niche. I was well known in a way for being able to connect women online to issues. And so she called me and she said, I'm going to hire you. And she gave me like a year-long contract. And that's why I'm such a believer in sort of pacing your career, in not leaping too soon, in developing your niche, all these things we'll talk about. Because to be honest, once I knew that one big organization could hire me, I knew I could make it work. Not to say there haven't been horrible blips along the way. But when I started liking Mondays again, I was so motivated to never let it stop. Yeah. And I still say that. If I mean, there have been days in my business where I have no money in the bank, to be honest, but it keeps me out there and going, because I think I have liked Mondays for 11 years. I'm not letting it go.
I think that is a really good barometer of success. So let's talk a little bit about the reframing of work-life balance to work-life fit and what you mean by that, and how, I mean, did you go on like a vision quest to find yours, or did it sort of evolve over time? So the concept, but then also your application of it.
So work-life fit is a great concept.
By the way, I just love the whole concept of a vision quest.
I would maybe one day. But I will say, honestly, my vision is to like Mondays. That is the vision in my head that keeps me going. It's not sexy. So work-life fit is actually a term that is trademarked by the wonderful Callie Yost, who is in my book, and I really recommend you check her out if you don't know her. She's incredible. Work-life fit is like a snowflake. No one person's work-life fit is the same. So we use this term work-life balance. And as an internet strategist, I know that when people search on these terms on Google, they still use the term work-life balance. I want to scream every time on the television some reporter talks about work-life balance, because we all know it doesn't exist, right? It's elusive. Whatever. Work-life fit is my individual exact match. It's like finding the perfect shade of foundation for my skin between how much I like to work, where I like to work. I like to work in bed and at home. Some people like to be out there every single day under the lights. Yeah. Some people like to work really intensely for 8 months a year and then not so intensely for four. Some people like to pace their day so they have a really busy morning and a really quiet afternoon. Everyone has a different work-life fit. You know, I'm a consultant. Some of my clients, they're empty nesters, and they say to me, I just get to work all the time now because their kids have left home. They don't have all those responsibilities. That's their work-life fit. Some young moms, you know, we always think that young parents, right, are juggling, right? It's the frenzied mom with the juggle. I hate that image. But some young moms and dads want to work all the time. That's their work-life fit. Some people who have no children don't want to work all the time because they want to go pursue their bliss. That's theirs. And so what I think is so amazing, and what takes all this stuff away from gender stereotypes and all the bull, is knowing what your work-life fit is and then matching it with your ambition, because that's important. Let's be honest. You know, I would imagine if you run a gazillion-dollar company that if you have a work-life fit like mine where you don't want to work all the time and you want to work in bed, that's a bad combination. And then also understanding your temperament.
Right. And so as you define your work-life fit today, how do you define it for yourself? Besides the goal of being excited about Monday and not working under fluorescent lights and writing from bed. is there anything else that you've really put together as somebody who's an introvert or as somebody who has navigated depression or anxiety that, you know, folks listening to this and in the audience can really sort of take away as like, oh, I actually could maybe do that in my life.
So I have four categories in the book that I think are helpful, and nothing's binary, right? I mean, we think that a career should look like this, and of course your career looks like this because shit happens, right? Right. So one, I like to think about what I want to maximize right now. Sometimes you might want to maximize money. You have to put kids through college or you're in debt. You're a money maximizer, an income maximizer. And so you'll pursue a work-life fit that maximizes income. Sometimes you might want to maximize your passion. You're so driven to make a change. You're really angry about the Trump administration. So you are just going to give it up and go work on a campaign. You're passion maximizing. Sometimes you're prestige maximizing. And I have no judgment against any of this, and we all may mix it up. I knew a lot of people when I worked in Washington, D.C., who were prestige maximizers. They loved walking into a party and saying, I work for the Senate Majority Leader, because that feels really good. I'm a flexibility maximizer. I will do almost anything to be able to retain autonomy over my schedule, over my time, over my space, over my pace. So I think it's really helpful to understand what intrinsically motivates you in your work, and then try to figure out the schedule and the fit around which you can manage those variables.
That makes a ton of sense. One of the things that I loved best about the book is I feel like you really articulated beautifully some of the things that have given you the flexibility, but could very easily at any point in time shift into prestige or shift into income maximization or shift into really any of the kinds of goals that evolve over time. And so you talk a lot about finding your niche. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about how you found yours and what have been the ways that you have looked for, or have you seen other people find their niche? Because it seems like if you find your niche, you know, one, life gets easier actually. Two, you can create a lot of value by just bringing people together who are in that niche, and do a lot more with a lot less. And most people kind of feel like niches are the kind of thing where it's like, oh, I'll cut off my options if I focus too narrowly.
Right.
Tell us about your experience with finding your niche, how you found yours. And do you ever have moments where you're scared that like it's too narrow?
So we're taught to think big in business, right? Obviously, duh. I think small. I think specific. And I think that one of the keys, if you want to be able to control your work-life fit, if you are that flexibility maximizer, if you want to be able, I mean, my whole goal, the reason I wrote this book was I woke up 3 years ago and I said, I want to grow my business, but travel less and network less because I hate it. How the hell do you do that? Especially when everyone's telling you all the time, never eat lunch alone, network more. Again, think about it, 6,000 conferences
document
a day.
Document your life. No matter what your face looked like.
Have a personal brand.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, all these things are like cliches at this point. If you have a niche, not only does it allow you to build greater credibility and fly less, but it allows you to stay focused and really manage your work. You know, I mean, you focus on building networks. I talk in the book about a woman I really admire named Ana Flores, who, like me, runs a very niche marketing company. It's called We All Grow. It used to be called Latina Bloggers Connect. And she and I would always laugh because we have these companies that people tend to pat us on the shoulder again, be like, oh, that's so sweet. You reach Latina women online. How nice. She would always get, or I would always get, oh, you do social good marketing to women in community. Not to mention the fact that women, of course, are 52% of the population and we vote more and we advocate more and we shop more. That's whatever.
Stuff gets done when the ladies are involved.
That's right. But the fact that we run these hyper niche businesses means that we can own our territory by being smart about how we cultivate that online brand, right? By being smart about our networks, by being smart about which conferences we speak at and which we don't. And it's a way to think, I think, really small, but really powerfully. You know, we are never encouraged when in business, certainly, to not go for it, right? To not jump on the rocket ship, as Sheryl Sandberg's favorite quote. But my whole point in the book is that someone like me, I could not be on the rocket ship. I would be flat out on the floor in a panic attack. Mm. I had to find a way to find just enough success and yet build that scaffolding and take care of myself, which is where the niche comes in. I will say that one of my favorite things, though, is in the book, I joke, my husband and I always joke about channeling your inner privileged white male, which is a very effective tactic. And so when you hear the name-droppy clients that I've worked for, that's all part of the strategy, too. So in the company, we might work really hard, we're lucky, on a presidential campaign, but that only lasts a few months. And then we can go back and do, you know, calmer work. But we get to say we worked for President Obama. And again, it's developing that niche.
So I want to suggest that you change small mm-hmm. to memorable.
Okay.
Because if you actually think about where we're at in the world, like what is our most scarce, most competed for asset that each one of us has? Our attention, our memory. And the beautiful thing about a niche is that it's memorable.
Absolutely.
Which means that you get scale from it, because it means that we're all going to walk out of here tonight. And when we think about women and mission-driven organizations, whether that's political campaigns, whether that is not-for-profits, or whether that is for-profit companies that have a very specific reason for wanting to get a message and a set of connections out in hyper-connected women-driven, female-driven communities, they're going to think about you. And anybody can take advantage of this as an introvert or an extrovert, because it's how, I mean, Facebook didn't start by connecting the entire world.
That's right.
They started by connecting one college. And they talk about that as the way that they generated value. And so I think you do such a fantastic job in the book, in an area I know something about, which is how do you think about your niche? And it's essentially a Mad Lib. And I think you do such a great job
totally
of articulating this, where it's like, if you think about a niche as being like this plus this, maybe plus this, but definitely this plus this equals a niche, you can open the world to be so much more your oyster, because you're more memorable in a time and a moment where we don't remember very much.
Well, and also you can be your authentic self. And I think that's really important. You know,
each of us are niches.
We're walking niches. and so one of the things I say is, you know, why would I compete with every PR and marketing firm, conglomerate, Omnicom, whatever out there? That would kill me. I could never do it. Instead, I literally, if you Google women online, you will find my business and some Russian bride mail order things, but that's okay.
It's a different niche.
But it's a niche.
Very
but
effective.
But you know, and I also, we talk about our mutual friend, Hillary Moglen in the book. I mean, this is powerful for selling too. You know, again, when you think about networking and you think about getting out there and making your mark in the world, the number one question I get when I give seminars is, what should I blog about? Right? Should I blog about my breakfast? Should I blog about politics? But I'm really, really passionate about baking pie. Well, my answer is always
bake the pie and then take a picture of it.
Find the way you can express the baking the pie. And powerful introvert salespeople understand this when they're out selling. They don't go to a random networking event, right? They don't walk into a giant crowded room and try desperately to meet someone, which is frankly what most of us when we're young were taught to do. They find that one event where our friend Hillary, like the 50 education policy nerds that she absolutely has to reach are going to be. she gives herself a job in that room and she's with her people. And so I think the niche concept is just so powerful. If, like me, and I think like many of us, you feel very overwhelmed and overstimulated by walking in to an unbounded anything.
Also, if you would like to do less work.
That's right.
And have better results.
That's right.
Because that actually applies to whether or not, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
So let's shift to networking.
Okay.
Because we are out at a fancy event in the middle of the heartbeat of San Francisco. And we both have talked about the fact that neither one of us like to be at events like this.
In fact, I interviewed you about this.
You interviewed, and I was like, I hate going to San Francisco. I like have to decide if I'm going to take the train or drive. Like, there's a lot happening. And yet we're both here.
We're here.
And not only are we here, but we're excited to be here. What, from your perspective, you know, gives you the energy and the excitement and that curiosity to show up at an event like this and have a fantastic time? And then change into your yoga pants, get into your bed at the respective hotel that you're going to stay at, and, you know, and recover.
That's right. I never stay with friends. I'm such a hermit, because when I've been traveling on my book, people say, oh, well, you can stay with us. And I'm like, no, I need to be in a hotel. So first of all, I will just say one of my tactics in the book.
You have a 14-point plan.
Yes.
For events like tonight, so, and I love it.
It's amazing. It's actually a 16-point plan on the internet. You can go download it. So first of all, the Commonwealth Club is on a list. I'm very strategic about what I would say yes to and what I would say no to. And an organization like this is on my list of things that I would never say no to in a million years.
I think that's going to be in the video.
Right? Yes. No, but real talk, it is, because it's high quality, it's impressive, I get people like you, and so I know that even if I'm going to have a panic attack on my way and want to quit and call my husband from the car and say, I can't do it, that I'm going to do it. And you should all have that list of things that you can say yes to, and you have to say yes to because you are ambitious, but things that you can also say no to. So that's number one. Number two is, I think what gets us out there, and this is true for all introverts. I mean, it's funny, you talk to famous actors and comedians who have stage fright and are introverts, of which there are many, and they all have a routine, but a lot of it is about tapping into the meaning of why you're there. And this is a tactic that most people use when they're scared, but is so powerful. And I don't know if anyone out there has fear of flying. I have tremendous fear of flying. And so every time I'm on the plane and we're starting to take off on the runway, I have that moment where I think, oh my God, is this it, right? And I have to tap into the meaning of why I'm on that plane, right? Whether it's because I have to help put three kids through college, which is income, legit, or because I love this work, or because I worked so hard to get this book out here, I tap into the meaning. So literally, as you're at the door walking into an event that you don't want to, or you're emerging from the bathroom, take a minute and think, how did I get here and why did I decide to say yes to this? It is so powerful. And if you can't summon it, have someone you can pep talk. Literally, text someone. Because once you can tap into the meaning and you can remember why you pushed yourself and you pushed yourself all past your boundaries, you're good. The other thing that I talk about is you got to have your battle armor, right? So I'm wearing a t-shirt and it says Reclaiming My Time, which is a wonderful feminist statement from Maxine Waters, but it's also a t-shirt that my dear friend Christine Coe gave me, and it makes me feel good, right? I wear red lipstick now because it really like makes me feel like I'm wearing my battle armor, and that's okay. That's not fluffy.
Right.
It's like getting into character for the person that you want to be. And so I think having a well-practiced routine and arming yourself to push yourself through the door is so powerful, and it's worth thinking about what you need to do Because it is hard. It's hard to get out there.
There's also, I feel like those were like 2 points. We've got like 12 more that you can find on the internet.
Yes.
Or when you get the book, it's on page 250. It's awesome. So actually related to going to events, networking, you do a great job in the book of talking about other ways to network and ways that in the same way that work-life fit is something that you can find the right combination for you and the right values and the right structure. You do a fantastic job of going through different ways of networking. So coming to an event, putting on a sweet t-shirt, which is, for those listening from home, awesome. Talk about some of the things you've seen amongst friends and colleagues and what people do around networking that you're like, okay, I'm going to steal that.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, I mean, I believe in online community. I had my very first, actually second job at iVillage.com when we had message boards. And I could see the power of people connecting in their jammies. Fast forward to blogging. Fast forward now to all the myriad ways we have to connect. And that is powerful. Anyone who tells you, and I guess I'm out here, so in Silicon Valley, maybe back on the East Coast, I still have to convince people. But, you know, I am a believer in finding your tribe online and making sure that that's a valuable part of your life, whether it's your kitchen cabinet of advisors, whether, and this is where, you know, I'm going to get just a bit nerdy, I think it's really important also to think about how you can use online social networks to build that bridging social capital. And this is really important when you come back to being ambitious. I mean, I could gab with my friends on Facebook all day and it would be fabulous and I'd still be at home and it would be comfortable, but it wouldn't help me meet new clients. It wouldn't help me get booked here to speak. It wouldn't give me access to outside worlds. And that's the question I get is, sure, I can be on Facebook. I love that. But how do I get a valuable professional social network so that I can be in my home office and still be out there? And here's a plug for you. You do a lot of this work, building networks of practice. You can start with LinkedIn. I actually am a huge believer. I'm a member of a bunch of listservs for my profession, for women in business. And we touch in a couple times a year. So I might have online super connectors. I have about 12 of them, people I've met throughout my career.
Describe what a super connector is.
A super connector is really valuable.
Fantastic concept.
Not my idea. It's social network theory. It's it is that person who connects you to people without you asking. It is that person, now it's sometimes it's called a sponsor at work, right? Someone who really goes to bat for you. I have a great quote from someone in the book who says, I don't know why I go out to networking events. The same 10 people have brought me all my business. We all have those 10 people. Think about who those 10 people are. And if you're anxious because you don't have them, which I actually spent a lot of time being, you can start. And it's not as hard as you would think.
So you only have to find one.
You need one.
And another way to think about it is that as an introvert, and I definitely consider myself an introvert who likes to pretend. I'm probably outing myself tonight as an introvert where I like try to pretend I'm an extrovert. But what I've found is that if I hang out with people and I'm friends with people who are much more extroverted and focused on and comfortable meeting a lot of people, then I can just draft right behind them.
Adopt an extrovert.
It's like adopt an extrovert.
Adopt that an extrovert.
A that is a t-shirt.
Adopt an extrovert. We all have super connectors, even if we think we don't. And I think it's really valuable. Treat those people really well. And if like me, I have social anxiety. So even the people that I love in my life, I get nervous calling them. I can't explain it. I feel like they don't want to talk to me. I never feel worthy. And so even some of my oldest friends in the world, I don't call them because I'm anxious. But I can email people. I can give people a recommendation on LinkedIn. Part of the reason I love blogging so much is once I started writing and now podcasting, I have an excuse to reach out to anybody virtually, and they'll probably talk to me. So I think it's about thinking, who do I want to meet? What do I want? And then what are the ways that I will be comfortable enough to get there? And if I'm not comfortable enough, is there someone I know who will literally go up and talk to anyone?
It's like the wing man.
The wing person.
Or
person. My husband is my adopted extrovert. I feel very lucky in that.
Yeah. One of the other things I've found that has reduced my own anxiety and also just made the whole thing more fun is if I know and I feel really comfortable asking my super connector friends, what do they want? Like, what's important to them? And if I have a sense of mm-hmm. the people who I care about, their hopes and dreams and goals, and they know what my hopes and dreams and goals are, especially for women, being an advocate for someone else is actually super expected. So you look sweet, and then your friend and super connector gets what they want, and the person who asked you about them or that you recommended them or said, hey, you guys should meet, or this person is fantastic for this, they think you're just like an objective third party. And so everybody wins.
Well, and it's not just expected, it's effective.
Yes.
All the data around women in negotiation, but I think this is true. I think it's actually not about gender. I think it is if you are the kind of person who is not comfortable in that alpha male FU positional stance of negotiation and selling, Alec Baldwin.
Which is also known as 99.9% of the population.
That's right. Always be closing. I win, you lose, right? We're both at the table. One of us is going to leave hungry, all that stuff. If you can do what Gina just said and always think, it's called generalized reciprocity, always think of other people and advocate on their behalf, you're actually going to get more. Especially if you're a woman. Data support this. Women who negotiate on behalf of something bigger, whether it's tapping into meeting or whether it's supporting their great friend, will get 15% more on average. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a big believer, and I call this using your introvert superpowers. I don't think it's about gender. I think it's about using your skills as someone who can tune in and listen and be mindful of how to help other people solve their problems. And to carry that out in your selling and your negotiating, and it actually makes you really strong.
So we're going to do questions in 5 minutes. So if you want to go to one of the person in the very back with the microphone, this is why having the person on stage with lights, fluorescent lights, I might add, coming down on you is hard. It's in the back left-hand corner. Please get up. There are questions to be asked, and we would love it. So as folks are lining up, again, this is an introverted crowd, so please, like, don't be shy. We're all in this together. So one of the things that, you know, as we've covered, you know, finding your niche, the thing you want to talk about, kind of some fantastic networking strategies, and also thinking about how to tap into not just, you know, your own volume-based networking, but also tapping into super connectors that love this and that you can draft behind. Talk a little bit about how you've navigated FOMO, fear of missing out, or in many cases, by making the decisions that we collectively make, actually missing out. How have you sort of thought about that? And, you know, how do you manage your sort of day-to-day? Your day-to-day FOMO, I should say.
I have intense FOMO. Right now I have TED FOMO. Because everyone I know has given a TEDx talk, and everyone says to me, you have to give a TEDx talk. And I'm like, I've gotten rejected from them. I mean, I have FOMO is the curse of where we are now, right? It is also the point of social media. It's what keeps us refreshing. Whether it's me looking at something amazing that my friend baked and put on Instagram while my children are eating Cheerios for dinner, or it's my friend who I went to college with who just got an award for her business, da da da. We all feel it. And we feel it in all aspects of our lives, from the very serious to the literally, why did she go jogging when I'm sitting on the couch like a lump? I mean, do you have friends or do you use those like exercise apps? Those drive me crazy when you jog and it's like, so-and-so went jogging and she feels great. So we're all in it together is what I want to say. And I think that FOMO, if you're a committed introvert and you've made your choice to be the flexibility maximizer and you're sitting in your yoga pants at your home office, it can ruin your day. Let's just all be honest, right? You take a little break on Facebook, everyone's out there, you're not. And that's just where we're at. What I try to do is I try to flip the script on FOMO. And this comes back to the reciprocity thing. I've learned in my head to try to congratulate the amazing person who is out there achieving something I'm not. Because it gets me out of my head. It gets me out of my horrible, anxious, depressive stewing. I mean, I'm a stewer. I will sit there and blame myself all day for everything I'm not doing. And so the simple act of actually saying yes when someone posts something amazing on LinkedIn, it gets you out of your head. So learn to flip your FOMO. The other thing is to know when to cultivate FOMO, because it's a very effective tactic when you have something you want to do. Right? When you have a new job, when you're like me, you're on book tour and you're hoping that in January you'll be able to stay home, but now you're out there. I have to cultivate FOMO. I have to make my life look amazing so you all want to buy my book. Like, that's just how it is these days. Right. So I think being strategic about how you're absorbing FOMO, how you're reacting to FOMO, and then when you need to, also cultivating FOMO, this comes back to the niche stuff, is really important. But we've all got it. We all feel envious, I think, these days. It's just
well, you answered my follow up question, which was how do you deal with a, you know, particularly bad bout of actual missing out or FOMO? And I think you articulate it so beautifully, which is flip it so that you are thinking about their success and congratulating them and being on the team. Sometimes I even just use the expression, I'm on the team.
Yes.
Even when at times I don't feel like I'm actually on the team, but if I say it, I eventually get there. So with that, I can see no questions, but I know that there's someone standing back there. So I think we're going to raise the lights and people appear. Wonderful. First question.
Do you have any insider, like, can you share a little bit about what worked for you in regard to getting better relationship with money, or if you did have a period of time where you were getting out of debt? Like, because I read tons of things of, you know, like, download this app, download that app, debt consolidation, like, just all this stuff, and I get overwhelmed. So I don't, especially with someone who I can relate to so much personality-wise, you know, what are some things that you did to kind of have a better relationship with money?
Thank you. I have bag lady anxiety. And I think I get this from my mother. I talk about my divorced parents, and I don't know if any of you can relate. So I always feel, I mean, money is what I'm always stressing about. And I wish I could say that it's done. But the thing that got me into a better relationship with money was actually looking at the cash in the bank and the numbers. And if you're a small business owner and you're an entrepreneur, you got to know how much cash you have in the bank today. And if you want to make a change in your life, if you want to take more control over your time, if you want to pursue that dream, it's the same thing. And so I have a lot in the book that I think you'll benefit from. I actually interviewed a financial therapist, which is a wonderful thing, a financial therapist. You have to have a relationship with your money where you're in a reality-based situation. This is how much money I have. This is my monthly nut. How much literally do I need every month? What am I willing to give up? What can I not give up? Does my money have a goal? These are questions that are very realistic. I, too, have been through the apps and the financial advisors, and it never works. What worked for me is trying to strip away the anxiety. And I have an amazing interview on my podcast today with Ashley Ford, who's a writer. And she says, anxiety is a liar. It's not true. Money anxiety is a liar. The numbers don't lie. So I think that is just a powerful and empowering way to start.
Great question. And answer, for that matter.
Oh,
Hi. I wanted to get back to networking. So you figured out what event you need to be at, and you're anxious about going to this event because you should be there. How do you, when you get to the event, I mean, how do you start cultivating small talk, or, you know, what do you do? Just stand around by the food or by the drink and hope somebody talks to you? Or how do you go about
pass hors d'oeuvres? Oh, everyone, I hate small talk. Well, Lisa Stone, who's in the audience, I quote her in my topic because she is a journalist and she asks people questions. And if you hate small talk, I really do think that this is the best advice. I call it channeling my inner Oprah. Lisa has this image of herself with her reporter's notebook. I always think of you with your reporter's notebook, scribbling. People love to be asked questions. And so I think that, first of all, take the pressure off. Small talk does not have to be amazing, and you do not have to meet the next savior of your life at a networking event. You just have to get through it, honestly. Honestly. So I think that taking some of the pressure off, but I have some questions that I start with. What brings you here? What was the most interesting thing you heard today? Banal. And I just keep going with the questions. And honestly, it works.
I would add one other thing that is a trick that I have found to be effective, which is I pretend I'm the host.
Ooh,
like everybody like has all like your mom told you, like, you're the hostess of your party. Like, make sure that you like introduce yourself to people. And if I put myself in a mindset of being the host, then I'm much more willing to be like, hi, I'm Gina. You know, how did you end up here? What are you most excited about tonight? And it's not necessarily natural, but I know how to play that host role. And so I don't think about myself as like the kid who showed up by themselves and needs to make a friend, but rather the person who's hosting the event, even if it's like a 6,000 person, like not my event.
Well, because you have a job.
Yeah.
I mean, I think
I gave myself a job.
That's great. And you gave yourself a job, and that's excellent. And it's not about whether people like you. You're working, right? Because when you're working, you can do it. And then just one other thing, which is Susan McPherson, who's mm-hmm. in the book, who's such a super, super connector. What she does is she asks people questions, and then she asks another person questions, and then she brings them together, and then she leaves. Yeah. And so that's another, you know, again, you're working. You're working. And then you can go.
These are our last three questions.
Great.
Okay. You talk about friends being able to set a 90-minute rule and tying in the money question. What advice do you have for someone who has to put on an extrovert mask in order to fulfill their position or role in a extrovert-driven society? And how do you maintain the intuition that often comes with being an introvert? And really being able to contribute fully in your role, because sometimes they really feel like they clash.
They do clash sometimes. And I think, again, if we are ambitious, and certainly if we're in certain jobs, we will forget, we'll be forced almost to forget we're an introvert because we're so busy faking our extroversion all day. But you're already there because you know. I think that if you are in a role where your energy has to be channeled outward and you have to be on all the time, the key is to manage your energy. Whether you can do that by chunking your day, building in really high energy activities, and then trying, if you can, to get an hour of quiet time. If you can get a morning to work from home.
How do you ask that? How do you ask for what you need from someone who is extrovert?
There's a whole chapter in the book about that. But I just want to tell you this, and I don't know what you do, and I don't know you, and you can tell me I'm full of it. Your boss doesn't want you to quit. It's expensive, and it's a pain in the butt. Ask for what you need. If a morning at home to do your work, look, they're listening. They're like, no. Ask for what you need. It's not a deficit. I just want to say that. Where is it written?
By the way, this is the kinks we talked about earlier. This is just like a slow-mo strobe light. Nothing to see here.
I just have to say one more thing. I just want to say, you know, if you're listening up there, where is it written that the extrovert who's always in the office and who's always willing to stay for one more round and who's always talking in the meeting is the most ambitious person? Like, we have to reclaim that. We have to reclaim our time.
And I've never met a boss, being a boss myself, who, if you didn't come into her office and say, look, what's the one thing you need me to do? Like, if I could kick ass on mm-hmm. one thing better than anybody else in the office or anywhere else, what is that one thing? And one, I bet they'll tell you what that thing is. And two, you then know the rest of the stuff you don't have to do, because at the end of the day, no boss wakes up in the morning and they're like, you know what? I really want somebody who's like great at attending meetings. They want you to do the one thing that you do uniquely and to an incredible level on your team. And that's what they want. And it doesn't feel like that at times, especially when people, you know what I don't like as an introvert? I don't like when people put invites on my calendar. And then they're like, oh, like, I'm like, what happened to my day? Like, so like, I basically like make sure I chunk it out. But if you understand what that one thing is, it becomes so much easier to say the rest of this is noise. I don't have to go out to lunch. I don't have to be friends with you. Like, I'm going to do my one thing. Yeah. Unless the one thing is going out to lunch with your colleagues or like going to
Well, and there's non-negotiables. We all know the non-negotiables, but carving out your time and your energy is absolutely your right, because I'm from Boston. If Tom Brady wasn't allowed, sorry, are we clapping? If Tom Brady didn't do his crazy routine to keep winning Super Bowls, we would think it was weird. So why do we prevent people from taking care of themselves to do their best work?
You want to be the Tom Brady of whatever that one thing is. Okay, and with that, we are going to finish. Wait, that was two questions. We got a third. Sorry, I'm blaming the lights. Let's go with our last question.
Oh, no.
We have two more.
We have two more.
Hi.
So when she said three more questions, she meant four. It's okay.
Hi. So based on the conversations that we've been having, it feels like we've been talking a lot about coping mechanisms, you know, for, you know, reclaiming our time, setting a 90-minute limit. And it kind of feels like we're acknowledging that we're living in an extrovert's world and we just kind of need to cope with it. I'm wondering if in your book at all you address how introverts might get extroverts to be more inclusive of us and be more understanding of how we operate versus it's an extrovert's world and we just got to buck up and find a way to live, you know.
That was buck up. I just want to be clear for those listening at home or censors potentially on the radio.
I'm so glad you said that, because I do believe in all of my heart that those of us who are more extroverted are equally strong and powerful and ambitious. And as someone who has anxiety also with her as her constant companion, that my anxiety is a gift, and that for many of us, if we can manage it, our anxiety makes us amazing at business. But I'm going to push back and say, I don't believe yet that we are at a place. Now, this may be different in certain industries and certain functions. But when you look at leadership culture, when you look at who our president is, I mean, he is the salesperson in chief, and the introvert who we knew was trying to push herself, lost, but for many other reasons. I think that we are absolutely living in a time where the idea of leadership and networking and getting out there and social media demands a level of presenteeism and being on that is actually unprecedented. So we better start changing things, because the workplace is toxic, and I don't love the fact that there are people up on stages telling us to crush it all the time. But I also to me, unfortunately, that's where we're at.
I want to add two things to that. One is it's not an extrovert's world. If you really think about how this technology has been built, it was introverts who basically said, hey, I can stay here. And if you guys all post on my stuff, that's going to work out really well for me. And so I would actually flip it on its head and say, how do you create, and I think this book does such a fantastic job of laying out really awesome frameworks for thinking about this. But even saying that this is an extrovert's world, we have to document everything. I look at it, I'm like, I'm not going to play into their stuff. Please note I said stuff. I thought about a different world, but it's PG tonight. And I think that it's really important that it's about creating the memorable thing, and that's why a niche is much more valuable and important than documenting your life, even when you live a fabulous life. It's important to get out there to the extent that, like, people remember that you exist and that you have a pulse, as a friend of mine told me the other day. But fundamentally, it's not an extrovert's world. It is a world where someone is making money off of your attention.
Yes.
And it is your choice to decide what you do with your attention. It might be a little bit of a soapbox.
No, it is. But I want to say one thing, because I feel very strongly about this. And my dear friend Cindy years ago had me read a book called The Feminine Mistake. Compromise is life. You can be an introvert, and if you want to build something really big, you show me that time spent working in your jammies or having quiet time and control over your time. I don't believe it exists. You have to make trade-offs. And that's not about being an introvert or an extrovert. If you want control over your time, if you want that quiet time, if you don't want to be booked all the time and be flying around the country and doing all these things, you're probably going to have to make trade-offs. And no one tells us that, but it's true.
And this is our last audience question.
So you talk a lot about, like, work-life balance, but I'm a student, so I can't really identify with, like, work yet. But I identify with a lot of the other things you say about, like, social anxiety and feeling overly stimulated by, like, constant inputs from a lot of angles and this pressure to find out what I want to do and this sort of pressure from different angles. So I was wondering, like, how you can apply your advice to, like, the workforce, but also, like, to me as a student.
Thank you for asking that. And actually, if you look at the data of students in high school and college, especially young women, the levels of anxiety and achievement pressure are historic and a little scary. I talk a lot about what I call achievement porn and an incredible pressure to achieve. And so I think what's really important, maybe when you're a student, there are so many demands, but it's to start thinking early about what motivates me intrinsically as myself versus what does everyone else want from me, and what is my coach or my mentor or my professor or my parents or my friends patting me on the back for versus what I wake up in the morning and really want to do. And that's a lesson that's hard won for many of us. And I would love ambitious young people to start thinking really critically about what drives them versus all the should messages that we are all getting to do more.
Beautifully said. But we're not done. So it is an Inform tradition to ask the following question, which is, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
60 seconds.
I'm not sure if it has to be done in 60 seconds. Or, like, you have 60 seconds to answer, but we'll leave that open-ended.
I think it's time for the patriarchy to go away. Everything we've talked about tonight actually touches on systems and norms that are perpetuated by patriarchy, right? And there is so much happening that is toxic in this world that is being perpetuated by a very old system of alpha men in charge. And Nilufer Merchant, who I think was a recent guest here, she has some incredible data that she found that even a lot of men feel trapped by the patriarchy. The whole idea of being that ambitious person who shows up every day. I mean, wouldn't it be an amazing world if you were at a law firm and you were able to work from home a couple days a week because writing is a big part of your job and you're super connected and you do your work really well, and you were just as likely to make partner as the other associate who was always there, who was in the sharp suit, who was taking clients out for dinner. Wouldn't that be amazing? And in my mind, it's all rooted in patriarchy. It's all rooted in the totemic, charismatic male leader. That's what has to stop. And if we want true diversity at work, if we want true diversity in life, we have to take into account everything, not just gender, but temperament, anxiety, introversion, feelings. So I'd like to smash the patriarchy. I'm not exactly sure how. I'm welcome to ideas.
The question does not require you to have a solution.
But I think a lot of it is about work.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is so great. I'm inspired.